You're listening to WPVM LP in Asheville, North Carolina. 103.7 on your dial and streaming globally at WPVMFM.org.
This is A Better World, coming to you from the studios of WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. My name is McNair Ezard, and I'm your host for A Better World. Each week, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations locally, nationally, and internationally who are working to create a world that works for everyone. And our guest today is Alexander McLean. Alexander is the founder and CEO of Justice Defenders. He is trained as a barrister and magistrate. After graduating from the University of Nottingham in 2007, he moved to Kampala, Uganda, where he created a team of local and international staff and volunteers to develop the work of the African Prisons Project, now called Justice Defenders. In the latter part of 2022, he spent time teaching at Grinnell College, as well as in men's and women's prisons in Iowa. He is a senior TED Fellow and UK Young Philanthropist of the Year. He appears in Time's 30 Under 30, Changing the World, and The Power List, featuring Britain's most influential people of African and African Caribbean heritage. Alexander McLean, welcome to A Better World.
Thanks, McNair. Thank you for having me.
Yes, appreciate you coming on. Can you give me an overall picture of what Justice Defenders is about?
We have a dream of a world where every person accused of a crime has a chance to tell their side of the story before they're convicted or punished or executed. We're working to create a world where we're equally accountable to the law and protected by it. We do so as a community of prisoners and prison officers who study and practice law together. Our work is to defend the defenseless. We train as paralegals and lawyers. We run 22 legal offices in prisons in Uganda and Kenya. We're just getting started in prisons in New York. And our posture is that we will welcome you and we'll help you to tell your side of the story, regardless of who you are, what you've done, what's been done to you, so your voice is heard in court. And ultimately, we create pathways from the bars to the bar, helping those who see with eyes that have cried, those with lived experience of the law, to move into positions where they become the ones to make and shape and implement the law.
So you're basically in the two countries in Africa and then starting in New York. Do you ever have organizations from other countries who are attempting to do the same work reach out to you to kind of find out how you function so that they can implement your structure in their countries?
Absolutely. Solidarity is one of our values. We recognize that when it comes to working for a more just world where we're equally protected and accountable, we need to join hands to do so, that we need each other in adversarial justice systems, that we need to work together as judges and prosecutors, prisoners, prison officers, the police, and other allies, and also that we need each other as different organizations. So we love to host visitors. We have many come from the US, but from around the world, and spend time with us in prisons in Uganda and Kenya, seeing what works and what doesn't there, and seeing how we can share the lessons that we're learning about how you equip those who see with eyes that have cried to defend themselves and their peers with the world.
So talk about why you initially went to Kampala and how that evolved to the legal aspects of your work.
Like you, I'm involved in hospice work. I became a volunteer at a hospice in London when I was 16. I realized quickly that I could learn a lot from the patients who were dying and their families. I read in a newspaper about a hospice in Uganda that looked after people dying in the community around Kampala, Uganda's capital city. My mum had worked for United Airlines, so I traveled a lot as a child, but I'd never been to Africa. I think my parents thought it was a risky, or at least an unknown to us as a family, continent. This hospice's work sounded amazing, and I wrote asking if I could go and visit in my school holiday when I was 16, but they said I was too young. When I was 18, they said that they'd have me. So I went off to Uganda by myself, not knowing anyone there. All I'd had was a VHS cassette this hospice sent me, which spent 20 minutes introducing their work, and I'd watched it countless times. So I went full of excitement and expectation, but leaving behind parents, especially my mum, who were filled with fear. My mum got shingles the day that I left for Uganda. I initially spent a month shadowing the hospice doctors and nurses as they went into patients' homes, taking them pain relief and other medicines and food as they died, often from cancer and from AIDS. It was fascinating, but there wasn't much I could do to be useful. Sometimes I was asked to say a prayer, and that was my contribution. One day we went to Malago, Uganda's National Referral Hospital. The hospice team went onto a ward to see a patient and take in morphine. As we went into this ward, I saw a man lying on the floor by the toilet, naked. I said to a nurse, "What's the deal with him?" She said he was found unconscious in a market by the police. We think he's a diabetic in a diabetic coma. We don't know his name. We don't know if he has any family because he doesn't have money. He doesn't get care. I saw that he was lying in a pool of urine and he was decomposing while he was still alive. I went back to the hospice and I spoke to my role model, the woman who's really shaped me, Dr. Anne Merriman. She went out to Nigeria in 1960 as a missionary doctor and nun and spent her whole life until she died last year, helping people to live and die well around Africa and beyond. She said, with a man like that, even if he's dying, he can die when he feels loved and cared for. So I went back to the hospital the next day and I bought a bar of soap and a towel and a blanket. And I washed him and tried to advocate for him. I said to the doctors, even though this guy doesn't have money or family, we don't know his name, can't you care for him? I did that for several days. And I came one day and he died the night before. A porter came with a trolley and put his body on top of a woman's body. I said they'd go in a mass grave with everyone else who had no one to bury them. And it was life-changing for me because it felt like that guy died without being seen or known by his community. It felt like his life didn't really have value in the eyes of those around him. I called my mum that evening and I cried for him. And I went on to spend several months in that hospital, washing and feeding and advocating for those that others had rejected. And medical students and student nurses and security guards and gardeners started coming alongside me from Uganda and around the world. And we were this ragtag bunch of unlikely allies who together would look after those that others had rejected. It was deeply formative. So I saw things which I could never have imagined, but it was very powerful to come alongside those others had rejected. And it was there that I first met prisoners. Since I was a little boy, I'd wanted to become a barrister, an attorney, but I hadn't gotten close to those who'd been in conflict with the law. So I started looking after people like Charles, who'd been arrested by the police for theft. When they arrested him, they beat him until they broke his skull in three places and broke his ribs and fingers. He was bleeding out of his eyes and his ears and his bottom when we met. Or a guy called Peter, who was 21 and had AIDS and cancer and Norwegian scabies, and all his skin was peeling off. I got scabies from him. I think proximity changes us. I saw that these guys in the prison uniform who were often rejected by the doctors and nurses and didn't get treatment because they are prisoners. Fundamentally, they wanted to feel seen and known and safe and loved, just like me. I bulldozed my way into Uganda's maximum security prison to see where they came from. They didn't have many British 18-year-olds wanting to visit, but I was welcomed, and the things that I saw there changed my life and led me in this path towards establishing justice defenders.
I was looking at a bit of your TED Talk, which I mentioned when I was introducing you. And you mentioned a quote from Nelson Mandela in which he said a country should not be judged by how it treats its highest members, but its lowest ones. And you can learn a lot about a country, the character of a country by its jails. In Uganda, what did you learn about the character of the country?
So my first visit to prison in Uganda was 22 years ago. I've made countless visits since then. I've lived there. What struck me on the first visit, in the first place I visited, was death row, and it was built for 50. Then it had 500 men, so it was packed. I was told that there were people there for treason and cowardice and mutiny and murder, for armed robbery, that if you stole a mango from a neighbor's tree using a penknife to cut it off, you could be sentenced to death as an armed robber. So the conditions struck me, the level of crowding. In countries like Uganda, many prisons, perhaps the majority of them, were built in colonial times when it was a British colony. Since then, the population has grown massively, but typically prison building hasn't kept up. It means that sometimes prison cells are standing room only. I was struck by the sense of solidarity. I walked past the gallows, At the top, there's a sign that says Danger Zone, Heaven Road. The prisoners called it Calvary. There was a geography high school class taking place on those stairs. I'm a passionate geographer. I love human geography and understanding how the world works through the eyes of people. And a man living on death row who completed his geography education was teaching his peers. So the prison's conditions struck me, but also the compassion struck me. I went from death row into the prison hospital. I went in, an 18-year-old boy died. His body was sewn up in a blanket to go in a mass grave. Place smelled awful. The windows were broken. They said it hadn't been repainted for decades. And what struck me there is that the environment that we're in affects how we feel about ourselves. I'm sure that you've seen it in your hospice and hospital work. I've seen it too. And I thought, even if someone's going to die in this environment, what would it look like if they died when it was dignified and hopeful? Because those things matter. And so I ended up refurbishing that prison hospital, working with prisoners and prison officers. And what I saw was a culture of interdependence, a culture of being in it together. The people who may not have underwear or shoes would give up their time, give up the little they had for the sake of the community. And I've seen that in abundance over the decades I've been doing this work. I've seen people with a generosity of spirit, regardless of the fact that they live in utter poverty, and people with a defiant hope. And again, I saw in places where one expects death, life, and places where one expects hopelessness, a tremendous sense of possibility. So that was my first inkling when I was 18, that prisons could be places of transformation. The prisons were filled with men and women who had gifts and talents and potential, which could make a difference in their immediate community in prison, but could also transform their families and their communities upon release. And I saw that sometimes you have to reach breakdown before you can have breakthrough. And in Uganda and Kenya, at the turn of this century, there was a shift towards open door policy, because the old way of keeping prisons locked, not allowing outsiders in, wasn't working. Too many people were dying from contagious diseases and from malnutrition. So actually, we need help. I think it can be like that in our lives as individuals, if we're struggling with addictions or other difficulties, and for government institutions. It's a similar conversation we've been having in New York recently on the back of a number of murders of incarcerated people there at the hands of correction officers. The commissioner saying, well, we need to find another way. And so what I saw there was that sometimes when everything you've tried isn't working, it creates a sense of possibility to ask, is there a new way, a more hopeful way, a more dignified way to do this?
I was reading a report. Let me ask you, though, have the conditions changed significantly, like for prisoners in Uganda, since you started years ago?
In the 20 years plus I've been doing this work in Uganda since 2004 and Kenya since 2005, I've seen a shift in mindset. I've seen that a language of human rights and human dignity is spoken about much more and much more fluently, especially when it comes to conditions for women in prison. I have seen quite dramatic shifts, especially in Kenya, where all women in prison now have a bed. This wasn't the case when I started out. And there are some very impressive programs to support women who are imprisoned with their children. And we work in prisons where children may accompany their mothers up until the age of 3 or 4, sometimes 5. Sometimes in bizarre scenarios where a woman's been in prison for child neglect because her child became sick. She took them to the hospital. There was no treatment. The child dies. Then the police arrest the mum and take her to prison with the rest of the children. So I've seen shifts in those areas. I've seen an investment in personnel. So in Uganda, there are more and more graduates coming to work in prison, and a shift from seeing the role of prison warder or wardress as one purely of command and control, to recognizing that these people can play a role in transforming the lives of some of our most vulnerable people. What I've also seen is tremendous population growth in these countries, and sometimes the justice system can't keep up with it. So when it comes to backlogs in police stations, in courts, in prisons, there are fundamental issues. And which is why justice defenders now, rather than working to make prisons better, as we did to begin with, through establishing libraries and health facilities, dealing with the fruit of the problem. We want to go to the root of it, which is injustice, and asking, how can we properly defend the defenseless? So there are reasons to be hopeful. There are resilient people with powerful visions for how things can be different. And frontline workers, judges, magistrates, police officers, and people living on death row who are trying to make things better for those around them with conviction, with passion, with resilience, with grit. But there's certainly more to be done.
Seeds of freedom, time must go.
If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Alexander McLean, founder and CEO of Justice Defenders. And you're listening to us on A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina.
Love we love God. Small seed, big tree. Everywhere just to share. Seeds of freedom. Seeds of freedom, love we love call.
Okay, that's Seeds of Freedom, and that's from the Playing for Change artist, and the album is Songs Around the World. And our guest today on A Better World is Alexander McLean from Justice Defenders. Alexander, I was reading a report from the Brookings Institute regarding statistics of the U.S. prison population. It said the population is largely drawn from the most disadvantaged part of the nation's population, mostly men under 40, large minority population with inadequate education. And to me, this says something about an economic and social system in this country that reflects itself in such statistics, a system where people who live in poverty are more widely jailed and sent to prison than those who are not living in poverty. And I'm wondering, is such the case in countries where you work, like Uganda and Kenya?
Absolutely, it is. And I spent time in about 135 prisons in about 20 countries, mostly in the Commonwealth, the former British Empire, where the justice system and prisons run along similar lines based on the foundations which were imported from Britain. And in this kind of environment, I think it's the case that often the law has been used to command and control and reinforce the status quo. And so we work in prisons with vagrants and debtors and street urchins and vagabonds and idlers. In many ways, it's Dickensian, the situations that we work in. And you can find that because of poverty, someone can be in prison for 5, 10, 20 years sometimes without trial. They're not educated enough to understand how to advocate for themselves. They don't have money to pay for a lawyer for themselves. And in 80 to 90% of cases, the government won't provide legal defense. So quite different from the situation in the US on that front. We ask, what does it look like to train those who've suffered at the hands of the state, those who see with eyes that have cried, in the law, so they can use it to defend themselves and their peers? That's what we do in our 22 legal offices in prisons, week in, week out, working on about 30,000 people's cases each year. We see about 10,000 of those we serve released, but also creating this pathway from the bars to the bar, training attorneys from prison, and doing public interest litigation to challenge unjust laws. We ask, should it be a crime to attempt suicide, as it is in Kenya and many other Commonwealth countries? Who benefits by imprisoning someone because they try to take their life, often because they're in the depths of despair or needing real mental health support? And I spoke before about child neglect, and I think about some of the women that we work with who are struggling to support their families, and maybe because they get back from work late and they're late to pick up their child, then they find themselves in prison for it. We don't think that in those circumstances, anyone benefits from criminalizing and imprisoning a person. So absolutely, there are fundamental questions about why do we have the laws that we have? Who do they serve that we want to address? And we think there's no one better to address those than those who see through eyes that have cried, those who know what it is to be tortured by the police or to be in prison for years without trial, to have no one to speak on your own behalf at court. We see that in prison, there are bright people with brains that can move mountains. So what we're trying to do is to build this new generation of those who've experienced conflict with the law, and we train them to serve others in our legal offices, to give them the look of love that they crave, but also to move into positions where they can be around the decision-making table in legal practice and in politics, saying, why does our system work like this? How can we reimagine it so that our justice system can help all of us thrive? It's generational work, but we have a passionate community of those in prison and from prison and global partners who are committed to doing it together.
I like the quote in a piece you wrote from Brian Stevenson, said, the opposite of poverty is not wealth. In too many places, the opposite of poverty is justice. And it sounds like that's what Justice Defenders is working on with those, with these folks in prison.
Absolutely. I think that when you have people who've typically got little education, little wealth, and little influence, and they find themselves in conflict with the law, and maybe from that point of arrest, they may have been tortured. They may have no understanding of what they've been accused of doing. They find themselves in prisons without knowing where to turn for help. I can't really imagine a more powerless situation than that. So as Justice Defenders, we want to build this community of servant paralegals and lawyers who will go to those who find themselves in those positions and say, I'm here for you. I see you. I want to listen deeply to you. And I help you to navigate this system. I help you to understand what's happening to you and how you can engage in it in a meaningful way. And this knowledge that I'll share with you, you can go on to share with others and create a ripple effect of spreading understanding of the law through our society.
When you started Justice Defenders or the African Prisons Project, did you run into any barriers from the powers that be, law enforcement or judicial system or government?
So I think when I was 18, no one thought that I could be a threat or disruptor to anything. And so initially I was welcomed. And to any young listeners or people who have children and teenagers in their lives, I encourage you to have the courage of your convictions. During my first years doing this work, and sometimes now, so many people try to discourage me that change is impossible. Who are you, they'd say to me, to think that you can make a difference when the problems are so deep? And often I say that I was too young to know better when it comes to doing this work, because I think sometimes the conviction of a teenager, the sense that there's right and wrong, the sense that this is just unacceptable, there has to be another way, that can be so strong. As we get older, we learn to compromise more and more. So to begin with, I was welcomed. Then I saw these things I couldn't unsee. I told you some of them when I was in my early 20s, went to Juba Women's Prison in South Sudan. When the gate was opened, I saw this woman with chains on her arms and legs. I said, why is she chained like that? The officer with me said, we chain our lunatics. It seemed that anyone could be accused of having mental health problems and then imprisoned indefinitely. And we also chain those who are going to be executed. Although South Sudan was a newly formed country, still hanging people. So what's going to happen to this woman in front of us? The officer said, well, with her and a number of the other women here, she hasn't done anything wrong. It's her husband who was accused of a capital crime, but the police couldn't find him. So the wife was arrested and tried and sentenced to be killed in his place. And I saw and heard stories like that, and it created a fire inside me. So to begin with, after seeing these things and thinking, well, I'm going to respond. And to start with, we established libraries and health facilities, believing everyone should have access to education and healthcare. The resistance sometimes came in the form of prison officers. We thought, who's this young guy with his young friends who are coming to change things around here? Or sometimes the materials that we brought to establish our facilities would be stolen from us. So resistance came again and again. But in part, I think we contributed to it because I think we felt we're here to serve the people who are imprisoned. These prison officers, they're corrupt, they're violent, they might be drunk on duty. Who are they? We were judging them. And with time, we saw the contradiction. And we'd say that we'd serve anyone in prison, regardless of what they were accused or convicted of, that everyone's life had inherent value. But then when it came to the correction officers, we were quick to judge them. So there was resistance there. And when we started this legal education work, we got unexpected resistance in one prison. We started training prisoners and prison officers in law to defend those who had no one to defend them. And loads of the prison population was being released. The head of that prison said, "Hey, guys, you can't work here anymore because I hire these guys out as my labor force. I'm losing too much money because you're getting my population sent back home." So we recognize the relationship of taking time to understand who you're working with, what their priorities are, and thinking about how you engage with the system to ensure that you're mutually aligned around priorities, you have agreements around what's needed to get the work done, and the importance of welcoming everyone to our table, not only those who look like they have perfect human rights and credentials, or those who say exactly what we want to hear, but recognizing that the experience of someone who's been serving for decades as a prison officer or as a judge or as a prosecutor, it's valid. They're part of the solution. So we need to welcome them. We need to listen to them. We need to respect them and ask, how can we work together to create the society that we dream of?
So did I hear you say that you also train prison employees to participate in this training program, legal education?
Absolutely, they do. We train prison officers, prison guards as paralegals, and we train them as lawyers. This year, we'll have our first two prison officers admitted to the bar as attorneys. One of those that we trained said, "Before you train me in law, I used to torture prisoners. Now I go to court to win them their freedom." We believe in transformation. We believe it's possible for prisoners, regardless of what they've done and what's been done to them. But we also believe it's possible for the rest of us, including prison officers. And often they have a profound understanding of the challenges facing those who are imprisoned. But they're frustrated that they've not been equipped to serve them, to respond to it. The head of Uganda Prison Service said on one of our videos, "We've got the gallows, we've got the executioners, but we can't be sure if we're hanging someone that they're actually guilty of a crime, because we know our justice system doesn't work as it's meant to." A senior Kenyan official says, "Can't turn it anyway when they're brought to us from court." But we think about half of our prisoners are innocent because they've gone to trial, they've had no one to speak on their behalf. They said, "Please train our prison officers as lawyers so they can work on their appeals and get the ones who don't need to be here out, so we can invest our resources in those who really do need to be here." And now we're proud of the beautiful relationships that we see between our correction officers and our incarcerated people. In some of our prisons, currently or formerly incarcerated people are training their officers in law. The prisoner is the teacher and the officer is the student. And we've seen that these relationships can transform the atmosphere in a prison, can help to reduce violence, create a sense that this is an environment where all of our lives can be changed for the better.
That sounds very hopeful. Are people that are trained, some of them remain in prison because of their sentence and they carry on the work as a prisoner?
Absolutely. So when it comes to those that we put through law degrees, we look for those who have at least 5 years remaining on their sentence, so they have time to complete their degree whilst in prison. But we find that once people start getting legal knowledge, even if they're sentenced to life or death, often they can find themselves quickly released because they can start advocating for themselves. Many of our best performing students have been on death row. We had to give early cohorts flashlights to study with because they were studying in the darkness, but their commitment and their energy and their ability was remarkable. The University of London has tens of thousands of law students around the world. The University of London was the first university in Britain to admit women. It has this remit of broadening access to tertiary education. Educates people in many fields, but especially law, in many, many countries. Their best performing student in the law of evidence, out of 3,000 or 4,000 who sat it, was a Kenyan prisoner. And so we're amazed by the commitment that we see from our students. We have local and international professors who teach them in person and online. And we see that whether they're in prison or they're released, they can make a transformative impact on their community. We have those who are now practicing as attorneys, others who are legal academics teaching their peers, others working for government, others working for law firms, others working for nonprofits, all of them bringing their lived experience the perspective of someone who sees with eyes that have cried, as an Oscar Romero put it, to their work.
Is the lack of legal representation, is that indicative of a more widespread issue that there's just a lack of educational opportunities for people in developing countries worldwide, and in this case leads to a lower number of people who have been educated as attorneys?
We know that education transforms lives, and when you invest in it, there's no going back for the person who received it, but also for their families. For a while, I was a visiting fellow at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and one of my students there said that he was a cycle breaker, and the education he received would break the cycle of his family for generations and generations of poverty and dysfunction. I thought it was a beautiful way to put it, and it stuck with me. I think that we're building a community of cycle breakers. So we recognize that talent and potential is spread around our societies equally, but opportunity isn't. And that education, including legal education, can be transformative, especially when you see with eyes that have cried, especially when you've suffered at the hands of the law. We work, at least in Uganda and Kenya, with governments that are under a lot of pressure from societies which have many needs in many different areas, and they're spread thin. And often criminal justice can be quite low down on the priority list, which means that access to lawyers can be limited. We also work in a world, I think, where crime doesn't pay in terms of lawyers who go into that area of law, often receiving very low pay compared to those working in other areas. So in countries like Kenya, where there's a relatively higher number of lawyers than somewhere like Uganda or South Sudan, which I've mentioned, you'll have those in legal practice who hesitate to get involved in criminal law because there's little money in it, because a case might take 4, 5, 6 years from beginning to end for the trial to take place. And that's why we're proud of this model of building the capacity of those within the system who live it, breathe it, understand it, and who step forward and said, use me. I want to serve. I've got the lived experience, but I don't have the knowledge to train me. I'm ready to apply myself fully, and I'll use this to transform the lives of those around me.
That's Alexander McLean. He's the founder and CEO of Justice Defenders, and he's our guest today on A Better World. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina, and we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. Okay, that's Nima, and the artists are the Narok prison inmates in Kenya. And our guest today on A Better World is Alexander McLean. He's the founder and CEO of Justice Defenders, and he's talking to us today from London. Alexander, here in America, I think everybody knows that racism plays a part in the justice system, and maybe we understand racism here differently than perhaps people do in other countries, but is racism a fact in how the justice is administered in the countries where you work?
Our dream is a world where we're treated equally at the hands of the law, regardless of any of our personal characteristics, including our race. In the communities that we work in Uganda and Kenya, the vast majority of the population will be black We have some clients from other countries that we serve, and we welcome everyone. In Uganda and Kenya, there are many different tribes. You can find that there are some tribes who are more likely to be represented or overrepresented in the justice system, and all sorts of factors behind that, including the location of the tribe, the opportunities available in those areas. The greatest factor that we see is the wealth of the accused person in determining whether they're arrested in the first place, whether they're charged after arrest, whether they're kept in prison, awaiting trial, whether their trial goes ahead. We work in societies where there are foreign populations, where there are asylum seekers and refugees, and we know that those without solid roots and a home, without a community to advocate for them, are more likely to be represented in our justice systems than those who have all of those things. And our dream is that those who have that experience of being an outsider, of having no one to speak on their behalf, can acquire legal knowledge so that they can speak for their communities and they can move back to the margins, taking that legal knowledge with them. As we begin working in New York, I absolutely recognize those issues of race, which you've just outlined. Since we started having US media coverage, chiefly from Anderson Cooper, who's become a great friend and storyteller with stories of our work, we've been approached by people in prisons and lawyers and judges in 30 states, maybe more. I think in some states in the deep South, we've had letters from people on death row in Alabama. We've been approached by those in Mississippi and Texas and Louisiana, where the issues of race and racism are so deep and ingrained. It could be very powerful to do this work, to build community of black and white, imprisoned and free, prisoner and prison officer, who study and practice law together. I was deeply shaped by the US civil rights movement as a boy, and the example of Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and so many others. And for me, it was profound to see how an oppressed minority could engage with the law with dignity, with thoughtfulness, with faith, to subvert unjust systems. And to drive from a place of pain and harassment towards societies where we can equally thrive. I think many of the elements of the civil rights movement, in terms of asking how do we build communities of interdependence, how do we not use violence but use our heads and strategically engage with the law to challenge the law, they're playing out in how we operate as justice defenders.
Do you anticipate, as your work takes off in U.S. prisons, the same sort of representation issues with prisoners, or do you see other things that you'll be working on?
It caught us off guard to have so many approaches from the U.S. We recognize that there are many organizations doing incredible work in prisons in the U.S. There are many justice organizations like Brian Stevenson, who you've quoted, who's mentored me as a huge inspiration, or the Innocence Project, the Vera Institute, the list goes on. There are many organizations doing incredible work already. We've had approaches from Australia to Zimbabwe, from dozens and dozens and dozens of countries to expand our work. We're actively discussing with people in Bangladesh and Pakistan and Fiji, amongst others, at the moment. But more than anywhere, those approaches come from the US. One of our values is solidarity. So for years, we've been listening and learning, having conversations, exchanging letters with mostly incarcerated Americans saying, why does this interest you? What have we got to offer you as this organization based in Africa, not with huge resources? What is it about us that's captured your imagination? We've been welcoming formerly incarcerated Americans and American lawyers and judges to spend time with us in Africa. Again and again and again, they said, we need this. I said that we've not seen an approach where you have correction officers studying alongside incarcerated people. They said, whilst we may have better access to lawyers and to defense than maybe the case in Uganda or Kenya, we want to own the law for ourselves. We want to understand it in depth so we can engage on our own behalf and we can take this knowledge into our communities and that we can play a role in shaping our society. They love the fact that we create a talent pipeline from prison into the legal establishment to help to strengthen it with lived experience, with people who see through eyes that have cried. So as we take these first steps in New York, and we're doing recruitment at the moment, who puts themselves forward? When we did a similar thing in Kenya about 15 years ago, we had one correction officer apply to study law alongside incarcerated people. Last year, we had about 130 correction officers apply. So we're asking, who are these trailblazers? Why are they interested in studying the law? What's most relevant for them? How is it to create classes where we have incarcerated people and correction officers studying side by side and breaking bread together? Because we're learning to do life as a community of people that's hated by many and expected to hate each other, but instead we want to grow in love for each other and those we serve. I think as we go on that journey together, starting with an initial introduction to law course, then moving on to more rigorous paralegal training, and then all being well, moving on to a law degree, asking, what are the needs of your community? Ask at every step of the way, how do we share the knowledge that we're acquiring with others? We put on TEDx conferences in the maximum security prisons in Kampala and Nairobi. In Kenya, we had the Chief Justice sharing the stage with a man on death row. We try to build community around our learners in prison, community that will educate them, shape them, journey them, employ them when they're released. It's a similar approach that we'll take in New York. We've heard about various matters for those in prison, which they want to be equipped to work on relating to their own cases and those of their peers, but also matters affecting their communities outside of prison, which they want to address. So we'll be listening and learning. Our academics and lawyers will tailor our training accordingly. We don't want to be to mandate exactly what those we train should do with the knowledge that they receive, because we think that they, through their lived experience, know best. Our first graduate in Uganda, Moses, studied law from prison, worked on his appeal, got his conviction overturned. He went on to be a prosecutor in the Ugandan army. I hadn't anticipated that we were training future prosecutors, but he'd been wrongly prosecuted himself, and there were no defense advocates in the Ugandan army. Actually, he had a profound understanding of the role that he was going into. He's done very well, and he's been promoted repeatedly since then. Others of our students have a passion for commercial law. To begin with, maybe I thought they'd be focused just on criminal law, human rights issues. But actually, law affects all of our lives from before we're born until after we die. And so it's natural that our people are interested in all aspects of law as well. What we know is that people in prison have often tremendous resilience and ability, and that when they study law, it equips them to move into positions where they shape our societies. And that's the dream that we have in New York. We're excited that Stanley Richards, a formerly incarcerated person, has been appointed as the commissioner for the Department of Corrections for New York City. And there are others who have lived experience who are moving into high-profile positions. Our hope is that we can expand that community. One day we'd love to have a Chief Justice who's been trained by justice defenders. Mm. But as I said, we recognize we're running a marathon, not a sprint. This is generational work. There's a rabbinical saying that says we mustn't get tired of work that has no end. And I think working for fair societies where we're equally protected by the law and accountable to it is a timeless job.
I mean, it's hopeful to think about that some of the most marginalized people in our society, people in prison, have a lifeline to self-respect, self-esteem by the work that you folks are doing.
It's fundamentally important that we live with purpose. All of us need purpose, and that takes different form. I sense that for both of us, part of our purpose is being a storyteller, and recognizing that that can shape the collective imagination. We were chatting about how we both volunteer in, we're involved in hospice and spiritual care work. Again, it's profound purpose. What I've seen is whether it's a Supreme Court judge, we've loved having Supreme Court judges from the UK and the countries we work in come into prison to give training to prisoners and prison officers who are part of justice defenders. Whether it's a Supreme Court judge or someone living on death row, each of us wants to look back on our day. I say my days counted for something. And when it comes to our time to die, to look back on our life and say my life's counted for something. On Thursday, I was with a woman called Ruth in prison in Kenya. She was arrested in her early 20s. She became a paralegal soon after her arrest. She said, when I came into prison, I was suicidal. As I said, you can be in prison for that. That wasn't why she was there. But then I became a paralegal and I started helping my fellow women and seeing these women I was serving being sent home, some of them pregnant, some of them going home with their small children. It gave me purpose. Later, she was convicted and sentenced to death. And she did her law degree from death row. Now she's had that sentence overturned and she's serving a prison sentence. But I think that desire for purpose is fundamental to our humanity. And I think with us, the sense of being part of a community that's journeying together, despite tremendous resistance, huge financial pressures, this work's not easy to fund. We say that we're a community of overcomers, and that's really our testimony, because many of us have been told to go and die, that there's nothing that you can offer this society, so you're going to now be executed. Others have been totally rejected by their friends and family. Many will have gone for years or decades without seeing their children because they're not allowed to come and visit them. But despite this, we've chosen this defiant hope as a collective and a bravery that may say that everything's been stripped away from me, but I still have the freedom to choose how I respond. As Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, Jew imprisoned by the Nazis in the Second World War, said that everything can be taken away from a man, but one thing. And that's how he chooses to respond to any given set of circumstances. And as justice defenders, we choose to be people of hope. We choose to be people who come alongside others and offer love, despite the fact that our own hearts may be broken or we may be grieving. And I think that this gives us something to live for. And when we fall down, we pick each other up. And so we continue as a ragtag bunch of unlikely allies walking with a limp.
That's Alexander McLean. He's the founder and CEO of Justice Defenders, and we are talking about their work in Uganda and Kenya. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM.
And they're all crying across the ocean, and they're crying across the land, and they will till we all come to understand. None of us are free.
Okay, that's Solomon Burke singing None of Us Are Free from the album Don't Give Up on Me. And today we are talking to Alexander McLean, CEO and founder of Justice Defenders. Alexander, let me ask you a personal question. I read one of your pieces on the website, A Revolution of the Heart, and I gather from that that you're a person of religious faith. Am I correct in that?
Yep, absolutely. I'm a Christian.
So how does your faith inform this work that you do with Justice Defenders?
I was walking this morning with a friend of mine, Father Martin, a Benedictine monk, who was my thought partner on that document. And we were reflecting on faith. And I think my faith is one that doesn't have to have all of the answers. In many ways, I think I've had a childlike faith. And the starting principle was that everyone is my brother or sister. So when I was 18 in that hospital in Uganda and saw the man dying on the floor in filth, I thought, well, Jesus said that we have to love our neighbor as ourselves. So let me try and love him. And that Jesus's example, like this subversive, countercultural guy who saw tremendous wealth in those that others had rejected. One of our law graduates, Susan Chigula, she was our first woman to study law. She studied from death row in Uganda under a mango tree teaching herself. She said, Justice Defenders finds treasure in the trash. And maybe it's a rough and ready way of putting it. But I think as I look at Jesus's life and example, that's the message I take, that there is no trash, that there's treasure everywhere, but we don't have eyes to see it. And that posture means that everyone should be welcome to our table, that everyone has a chance to serve, and everyone has a chance to teach and share their experience with others. It's a posture that says that regardless of our flaws, regardless of the harm that we've done, each of us has an inherent worth, and each of us can make a positive contribution. And we're a community of Christians and Muslims, people of other faiths, and none at all. it's important for all of us to recognize that this is hard work and heart work, and that we have to be attentive to our hearts as we go. In many ways, offering legal education and legal practice, it's not hugely complicated, but to do it in a way that allows us to overcome some of the trauma that we've inflicted on others and had inflicted on us, that allows us to keep doing it together as unlikely allies, means that we have to think carefully about how we guard our hearts. I love Oscar Wilde's saying, the British novelist who was imprisoned in Victorian times, said, "The problem with prison isn't that it breaks your heart. Our hearts are made to be broken, but rather it turns our hearts to stone." And we're asking, how do we keep our hearts soft as justice defenders and as a community with a strong orientation towards action and doing, but also making space for contemplation and reflection together and being attentive to each other's well-being. Yes, so my faith has sustained me in doing this work. And Jesus's life, I guess, it has been the example which I've tried to follow with many shortcomings and flaws, but that example of valuing each person.
Now, on your website, it talks about some 5 billion people who don't get justice they need around the world. And many people here in America know that the justice system in America is broken, and I'm sure it is in other countries where you work. With such numbers, does the issue ever feel impossible of improving? I know you said it's a marathon, not a sprint, but what do you think about that? Is it ever feel too large to attack this issue?
I feel unbelievably hopeful because the places that we work are some of the most challenging places you can imagine, which they don't always have light or running water. They have almost every disease that you could think of. And yet we've got people who can get first-class marks in really tough law exams and transform their lives and do public interest litigation and get laws overturned. So I think that the resilience and the grit and the determination, especially of those on the margins of our society whose potential is often overlooked, is tremendous. My dream is, how can we establish a legal college that around the world is training those on the margins in law, training them as servant lawyers to defend the defenseless and to reimagine justice for our communities? And at the moment, we train people who are imprisoned, who've been refugees, or they've been prostitutes, or they've been in homeless shelters, and asking, can we create a law school that moves into the refugee camps and the homeless shelters and the brothels and provides legal education there? Gilbert Bukenya, who is the former vice president of Uganda, said, "You're starting a revolution that you might not live to see the fruits of," maybe because revolution takes time rather than anything more sinister. He said, "You're a Trojan horse organization." Really, that's what we're trying to do, to create pathways from being marginalized to being in the heart of our communities and to playing a role in shaping justice so that it serves us all and it protects us equally and holds us to account equally. I'm so encouraged by human resilience and kindness and grit and by what happens when we reach out to each other and seeing how it's possible. Last week I was with a lady called Rahab. I've worked with her for about 15 years. She was a notorious carjacker and armed robber before she went into prison. And in prison, she became a drug dealer. You name it, she did it. And she was with one of the prison officers who had guarded her whilst in prison. And they were speaking about the interaction and how sometimes he beat her up in prison. But he also refused to be involved in her drug dealing schemes. And they became friends. And now she's been free for many years. And he comes to her house for dinner, and they spoke about what their relationship meant to each other. And I'm kind of in awe because I can't understand always the capacity people have for forgiveness or for creating friendship where it seems that there's no foundation for it. So I think that the human spirit is a remarkable thing. And so as I look to the future, despite the uncertainty and the fact that sometimes I look at crimes which have taken place in the countries we work in or close to home, and I'm deeply shocked by them, I think that there's a role for imprisonment. But what we want to see is our justice systems functioning fairly, our prisons being places where lives are transformed, where people can have second chances. So, yeah, I'm in awe of the community that I'm part of and the community that I serve, and I'm filled with hope as I look to the future and I dream of how we can expand it with this legal college and with a law firm. And we'll open in Kenya by the end of this year, a law firm of lived experience where those who've suffered under the law, who've been admitted as attorneys, are practicing and in some cases charging a fee to make this work more sustainable. So we live in uncertain times, but I'm full of hope.
Getting near the end of the show, but let me ask you, is there a way for people to get involved with the work of Justice Defenders?
People support us in many ways. The number one thing that we need at the moment is funds. We're looking for support for this work in New York, which is just kicking off. We don't have all the funding that we need for it, but we're stepping out in faith and recognizing that as we build community of unlikely allies and we invite people to come and learn more about it and spend time with them, that community will speak for itself. We're hoping to take on a new cohort of law students in Uganda to start their studies in September. We're looking for support with that. There's an Ebola outbreak in Uganda at the moment. We know that during outbreaks of infectious disease, like in COVID, people in prison are incredibly vulnerable, especially pregnant and women and those with their children. So we're thinking, what's needed to respond on that front? In COVID, we were told we want to be safe, and so we want masks and soap and sanitizer. We want the wheels of justice to keep turning, so we establish internet and mobile courts, which have helped hundreds of thousands of people to go to court online. We want to be at home with our families, and we started a fund to pay fines for those who might be in prison for 2, 4, 5 years because they can't afford to pay a fine, often of a few hundred dollars. We welcome international lawyers and legal academics to come and spend time with our community, training them, forming them, equipping them. We have other volunteers who don't have legal backgrounds. And I recognize the opportunity I was given when I was 18 and had so little to offer the hospice in Uganda. They said yes to me. And this is multi-generational work. And we need to have senior leaders like the Supreme Court judges who help with our legal education. But we also need youngsters who come with energy and fire and passion, which helps to spur the rest of us on. So if you're interested, please have a look at our website and don't hesitate to reach out, including to me directly.
Any final thoughts you'd like to share?
Thank you for allowing me to have this conversation. An important part of our work as justice defenders is asking how can we influence the collective imagination around what's possible. Our work is focused on prisons and justice systems, but I hope that anyone who's listening to this, who's brokenhearted or deep in shame, will feel that for whatever reason you don't have a contribution to make to society, will reconsider that position. And perhaps I can leave you with a blessing. I think it's a Franciscan blessing, which in many ways has been a mandate for us as justice defenders. May I?
Please.
It says, may God bless you with discomfort at easy answers, half-truths, and superficial relationships, so you may live deep within your hearts. May God bless you with anger at injustice, oppression, and exploitation of people, so that you may work for justice, freedom, and peace. May God bless you with tears to shed for those who suffer pain, rejection, hunger, and war, so that you may reach out your hands to comfort them and turn their tears to joy. And may God bless you with enough foolishness to believe that you can do that which others say cannot be done, to believe that you can make a difference in this world by bringing justice and kindness to all our children, especially the poor. Amen.
And on that note, I want to thank Alexander McLean, founder and CEO of Justice Defenders. Alexander, thank you so much for coming on the show, and all the best to you and the people at Justice Defenders and the work that you do.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure spending this time with you.
You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with Joe Satriani playing The Forgotten, Part 2 from his album Flying in a Blue Dream.